Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the Long Island Law Podcast. I'm your host, Zahava Schechter. The premise of this podcast is to feature issues, developments, and topics affecting the law and how it relates to the 8 million of us who live or work on Long Island, New York, which includes Suffolk, Nassau, Queens, and Kings Counties. If you live or work on Long Island, this podcast on local and state legislative and judicial decisions is for you. Our guest on this fourth episode is Daniel A. Johnston, Esquire, an attorney specializing in criminal defense, personal injury, and business and consumer litigation. Dan's motto is, call me when you're arrested, injured, or ripped off. Dan is a former prosecutor in the Nassau County District Attorney's Office who has also handled civil litigation defense matters in large New York City firms. Dan's practice focuses on helping individuals and small businesses when it matters the most, mainly criminal defense and plaintiff side civil litigation. So, Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Okay, so let's get right into it. Please tell our listeners a little bit about your law practice.
Sure. I maintain a solo practice in Mineola. I do work in Suffolk, Nassau, Brooklyn, and Queens. I do criminal defense for those who have been charged with crimes. I also represent people who have been injured through the negligence of others. I also practice enforcing the private rights of action in relation to consumer law. So if you were defrauded in relation to contracting, you were ripped off by some product, I work to make those people pay for doing wrong things that the government may not necessarily have the time to pay attention to.
Okay, very good. And to our listeners, please check out the show notes for Dan's contact information. And I want to remind you, please keep in mind, we will not be providing specific legal advice to any particular questions. So Dan, let me ask you, what are three tips you would give our listeners if they are stopped by a police officer for a traffic infraction?
Sure, that's something that most people will face at one time or another. My top three pieces of advice in relation to that would be, number one, be polite. They are just trying to do their job. They're not happy to have you pulled over, just like you're not happy to be pulled over. Being combative or angry or rude with them is not going to help your cause, especially at the scene. The second thing would be, following that, don't be combative. It's a little unusual in that nowadays we have people who have seen how-tos and videos on YouTube as to how to exercise your rights, and that is important to exercise your rights. But a lot of the time, the battle to be fought is in the courtroom after the fact. It's not at the scene. You're not going to endear yourself or have a police officer say, oh, hey, you're right, I'm going to let you go. It's just not how it works.
Let me ask you, I've been reading in the newspaper and seeing on TV, people are using their smartphones to record actual police stops in case there's a question later on as to what happened. What is your position on that? Is that admissible evidence in court?
Absolutely. If you're the one taking the video, then you can testify as to its accuracy, and that should be something that's admissible. And generally speaking, officers should not be opposed to having their interactions with the public videotaped. I have seen recently people have started to purchase dash cams for their personal vehicles, and that's a great investment because when you are pulled over, if you pull out your phone and you're telling the officer you're recording them, it adds to tenseness of the situation versus if you just have a dash cam that's always running, it's a lot easier to deal with. And I have had cases that people have been able to reach favorable results because of the fact that they did have a dash cam and did record the encounter. It is important.
So in Phoenix, Arizona, I think in the last week, there was a bystander who recorded with his smartphone or her smartphone an interaction between the police and a woman with, I believe, two minor children. If you're a bystander, you're just minding your own business and you see the police stop someone, what is your recommendation as to whether that bystander should get involved by filming the interaction?
I don't believe there's any harm that comes by recording. It's always been said that the best solution to corruption is sunlight, and you don't get much more clear than video footage. And officers really should not be put off by the fact they're being video recorded. If they're doing their jobs correctly, they have nothing to be worried about. So I would, generally speaking, if you see something going on that you're uncomfortable with, record it.
Okay. And do you see this as a racial issue or as a gender issue? Is there any particular indicia that police are acting upon, do you see, when they stop people, or is it more random?
That's a big question to answer, but I would just take note that it is true that the African-American population makes up a single-digit percentage or a small two-digit percentage of the population, and yet they represent 33% of those incarcerated. While I can't speak to individual officers, who there are many lovely officers who I've met who are excellent at their job and don't have bias, there are very clear systematic biases that are in place against minorities. And I do believe that that is affected when people begin to record. You'll see a drastically different reaction when you happen to have an African-American man starting to record his encounter versus a white man recording their encounter.
Do you see a difference between the genders, between men and women, or less so?
Not so much. I haven't really seen too much bias as against women, especially when you're talking about lower level traffic stops. I don't believe gender plays as much of a role as race and certain other criteria.
And how about between the counties? Is there a difference between a traffic stop in Nassau County or Suffolk County as opposed to the city?
I would say that there is. It also depends on what you're being stopped for. Nassau is notoriously hardline in relation to DUIs, and if you're even anywhere near the limit, you're going to have a hard time in Nassau.
So let's explain this for a minute. DUI is driving under the influence.
Yes.
And could you explain that to our listeners, please?
Sure. If you are pulled over, the police, if they suspect that you have been drinking, they can perform what's called SFSTs, or standardized field sobriety tests. They'll also most likely have you do a PBT, which is a portable breath test. Does a quick check of your blood alcohol content.
Do you, as a motorist, do you need to agree to that?
That's part and parcel of agreeing to have a license. It's part of the privilege of having a license, is that you agree to submit to a chemical test of your breath.
So are you saying that a motorist who is requested by the police to perform these tests cannot say no?
They can. There's a separate criminal charge that usually is the result, which is an 1192.3. If you blow and you're over the limit, it's an 1192.2. If you refuse and the police believe that you are intoxicated, they can still arrest you. It's frequently referred to as common law DUI.
Okay. And DUI all includes both alcohol as well as drugs?
Drugs have a separate provision. It's 1192.4. Usually that involves either common law police observations, or it involves having a blood test taken. It's far less frequent that people will be arrested for an 1192.4. You just don't see it as frequently as an 1192.2, which is a blow, or an 1192.3, which is you refuse to take the test.
Obviously, this is a very in-depth conversation, and our podcast does not lend itself to get into the specifics. So if any of our listeners are interested, they can follow up with you on in your contact information.
Absolutely.
And what about searches in the car or in your home? What would you advise our listeners to do?
Unless they have a warrant, refuse. That goes back to the three tips in terms of a car stop. The third tip would be you never consent to a search unless they either have a warrant or there's some other indicia that a search is warranted. The most frequent one would be you get pulled over, the car smells like marijuana, they're going to have grounds to search. But if you have any option in the matter, you voice your non-consent to the search. You say, I do not consent to being searched. This will, at a minimum, at least preserve the issue to be battled at later in court.
But doesn't that turn into a he said, she said kind of situation where unless you're recording the interaction, the police officer may not admit that, in fact, you asked for it?
Of course, that does turn into a he said, she said, but at least there's a good faith basis to pursue suppressing whatever evidence they obtain. It also goes back to the fact that even though you're driving maybe your own car, you don't know what you've either forgotten about in the car. You don't know who's been a passenger, if they left something. I mean, there's cases where people can get charged for having unlawful possession of a weapon because they've got a baseball bat in the car. It's a risk that you shouldn't needlessly take. And in most situations, most cops, if they do not have a warrant and you say, I'm not consenting to any searches, most of them will do their jobs.
But at that point, are you arrested and taken to the precinct? No. So what would happen if I'm stopped in a car and the police officer requests the my permission to check the car? And I say no. What happens to me? Does the police officer let me go?
Depends on the officer. Depends on the circumstances. If they have other means or other legal authority to search the vehicle, like I said, if there's some other indicia that there's criminal activity going on, if there's a dog that, you know, they have a drug dog who sniffs the car and alerts to something in the car, if there's other grounds to search the car, they still will. If you say, I'm not consenting to any searches, and they don't have any other legal authority to search, they should just be giving you whatever ticket they're supposed to give you and letting you go.
Okay, this is a fascinating subject. We could talk about it all day, but we were going to move on to something else. So now we're going to move on to our segment called What's on Your Desk, a recent file, which you can use to illustrate a teachable moment to our listeners. So what is your What's on Your Desk, Dan, moment?
Sure. So I have two cases that I believe there's some lessons to be teased out of. I have one client right now who was arrested for assault, and he has a rock-solid alibi that's backed by GPS records and business records, neutral evidence that establishes he was two counties away when the crime happened. He literally could not have done it. His case is still pending, despite all of that evidence being submitted. I have another case where it's a DUI, where she was supposed to be being sent to a specialty court for treatment, but the district attorney's office on this particular case didn't take notes of the meeting that I had with the supervisor. They didn't write down the offer or mark up the file. And as such, she's not in the specialty part and nothing has happened on the case. The point of these two cases I'm discussing is that patience is really the key to maintaining your sanity when you're facing criminal charges. Nothing happens overnight, even if you know you have slam dunk evidence that you're innocent. Nothing happens overnight, and it really goes to show that the most important consideration in hiring a defense attorney on your behalf is that you trust them. So much is happening beyond the courtroom and beyond what you see. I would be fair in saying that 90% of handling a case doesn't take place on the record. It doesn't take place in a courtroom. You have to know that your attorney is doing what needs to be done and knows what needs to be done.
Yeah, and as a former prosecutor, Dan, you're very familiar with the process. So let me ask you, what are the chances of a defendant in a criminal case who is not represented by an attorney to deal with all of the complicated discussions, most of which, as you say, are outside of court? What are the chances of that pro se defendant?
A pro se defendant is going to have far lower odds of getting as favorable of a verdict as possible, simply because of the fact that there are so many intricacies and in the weed details in defending criminal action. There's options for relief they're likely not going to know about in terms of having evidence suppressed, statements suppressed, swinging the evidence your way when it is presented to a jury. That being said, there are some circumstances where a pro se defendant is going to be able to get just about the same outcome as a represented party. If it's run-of-the-mill vehicle and traffic law violations that happen to end up in criminal court, a lot of the times there are standard pleas that are going to be offered to every defendant. In those cases, a pro se defendant is probably going to do all right. But if it involves serious questions of fact, and if the DA is really gunning to take it to trial or hold them to the charge, a pro se attorney is going to be vastly outgunned, and they are not going to be able to get as good of an outcome as if they had an attorney.
Okay, thank you. So we have three very important issues to discuss today. The first issue concerns the Keith Bush exoneration, and I'll give some background to that. As our listeners may know, Keith Bush was 17 years old when Suffolk County police arrested him for allegedly committing a sex-related murder of a Belport High School teenager following a neighborhood party. Keith was convicted and spent 33 years of his life in prison and more years afterward on parole as a convicted sex offender. Keith maintained throughout all of the years that he was innocent of the charges and that the police coerced his signature on a written statement, not written by him, and only after many hours of physical and emotional abuse while in police custody. Although a minor at the time, he was not allowed to contact his mother or speak with her or an attorney during the approximately 11-hour interrogation. Keith is now 62 years old. With the election of the new Suffolk County District Attorney, Tim Sini, the current DA's office provided information to Keith's defense attorney attorneys that at the time of the murder, the police knew of another potential suspect but did not disclose it to the defense attorney as required. On May 22, 2019, Bush's murder conviction was vacated. While we applaud the new Suffolk DA's integrity in admitting this grievous mistake, how can we not be appalled by the illegal and immoral actions of the Suffolk County Police and District Attorney's Office in 1975 and onward in prosecuting and convicting an innocent man of a crime he did not commit, and in the failure of the judicial system, the police, and the district attorney since then? Now, Dan, you're a former prosecutor turned private criminal defense attorney. What is your take on this matter?
This matter is atrocious. It enrages me at every level. You have someone who is a minor at the time being detained by police without a parent or guardian present, being coerced into a statement that ends up putting him in prison for 30 years. And we're in a system now where I don't necessarily understand beyond the, yes, it is good that the Suffolk County DA took a look at this conviction and went back and investigated and ended up assisting in overturning it. But the fact of the matter is, it took over 30 years to correct this mistake. And this man has been involved in the criminal justice system from the time he was 17. He's now 62. This man's life has been absolutely destroyed. And we're sitting here 30 years later saying, oops, this is atrocious. This is part and parcel of why some of the litigation that hasn't made as much news this year is so important. There's been legislation passed that starting in January 2020, the discovery rules in New York for criminal cases are being completely overhauled, and it is long overdue.
Could you explain to our listeners what the discovery rules are?
Discovery refers to documents and things that you are entitled to take a look at, get a copy of, review.
As a defendant.
As a defendant, in relation to your arrest. So certain arrest reports, any negative information about witnesses that are going on the stand. Now, there's been some disclosure that's standard practice, especially as it relates to Brady, which is Brady material is if there's something that's beneficial to the defendant or tends to exculpate them from liability, the prosecutor, in theory, is required to turn it over. Part of the problem is that all of the documents that are held by the DA's office and the police, they are so insulated from any oversight. If they don't turn something over, unless it's just by happenstance or an excessively persistent defense attorney who manages to get their hands on it, no one's ever going to know. So the whole idea is that, yes, they have this obligation to do this, but no one is checking. And there's other aspects of this case that are equally appalling in terms of when an investigation was done into the circumstances of his conviction. When the Conviction Integrity Unit of the Suffolk County DA's office interviewed the investigating detectives on the matter, one of them referred to him as a racial slur who should have been executed. And this is an officer who had a nice long career and is still continuing to collect a pension on the taxpayer dollar. And this is someone who clearly blew it on one of the biggest cases of his career, and is not only that, turning around three decades later and lambasting someone who was wrongfully convicted.
Do you think that there is pressure on prosecutors to convict? Is it a win at all costs mentality generally in the prosecutor's office?
I think it dramatically depends on which prosecutor's office we're talking about. The tone at the top is very different in different counties. There are some counties that focus on the numbers and they just want to maintain a high conviction rate. At the same time, there's programs that have been implemented, and I will give credit, even though I'm very frequently negative, I will give credit to the Nassau County DA's office in regards to their newly implemented Phoenix program. I'll give them credit in relation to their ADP program and their treatment court program. All of these are excellent programs. The Phoenix program is designed to take young people who have found themselves in the criminal justice system and try and rehabilitate them before they become return customers. It tries to intervene and provide them any type of treatment or anything else that might put them on a better path.
And are there any studies yet about the recidivism rate, if it's actually helping these people once they're out of the system?
The Phoenix program is fairly new. We're talking within the last year or two, having been rolled out. So I'm not aware of any studies as it relates to that program specifically. Also, the ADP program is designed for minors who are under the age of 18. And it's an incredibly important program, especially in New York, where you can be deemed an adult and face trial as an adult at 16 years old. So I really do applaud the DA's office for taking the effort and taking this at-risk population of people who are between 16 and 18 and providing a program that's better suited towards getting them on a better path instead of trying to whack them over the head with the criminal justice system.
Again, this is Nassau County, Madeline Singus, correct?
This is Madeline Singus.
Okay, yes. Very good to know. Now, we talked before about race and whether that applies or changes the situation in a traffic stop. Do you think that race played any role in this case, Keith Bush being an African-American teenager at the time? Would a Caucasian male on Suffolk County have been treated the same way in 1975?
It was indisputably a factor in this case. You have the lead detective 30 years after the fact calling him the N-word on record to the conviction integrity unit. You don't get much more blatant in terms of your bias than that.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, Keith Bush will probably file a lawsuit against Suffolk County. It's been reported. Do you think that the case will go to trial or will it settle? Not that I'm asking you to make predictions. And if it does, whether go to trial or settle, do you think Keith Bush will receive a large amount? How much is sufficient and could compensate for imprisonment and mistreatment for the past 45 years?
I don't think there's any amount of money in the world that will make this man feel better after losing all of his prime years in addition to some extra years. He was in the system from 17 till 62. That's the lion's share of his entire life. There's no dollar figure that's going to make that better. I do 100% believe he's going to be filing a lawsuit, and he absolutely should. In regards to whether it's going to settle or go to trial, given that the Suffolk County DA's office was somewhat integral to getting him released, I do think they're going to be coming to the table to talk. I don't believe that they're going to be fighting this out. As to the amount, it's almost impossible to say. I mean, there is some precedent that there were two people last year who had a conviction vacated in Nassau County for a joint $43.7 million judgment. Now it's for two people. And that was for a conviction stemming from 1984. This gentleman's been incarcerated in the system even longer. I don't think it's out of the ballpark that he's looking at $30 million or more.
Okay. Well, we'll follow that case and see what happens. A second matter which we're following very closely is the new law passed by the New York State Legislature and signed by Governor Cuomo to provide undocumented New Yorkers access to a driver's license. Proponents have said there are three benefits to the proposed law. One, road safety improves as drivers would be insured and accidents would hopefully diminish. Number two, New York State and other local counties would get more money as there would be new licenses and registrations for which drivers would have to pay. And three, undocumented drivers are under greater risk of deportation and arrest by ICE. Certainly on the island, people need to drive as public transportation is insufficient here. Dan, you represent drivers accused of DMV violations. What do you think of this new law?
There's a lot to unpack in this law, and I believe it started as something with good intentions, but it's been written so overbroad that these benefits they're talking about are never going to see the light of day. First of all, and I'm just going to address the benefits they cited first, as to it's going to make the road safer because more drivers are going to be insured. That assumes that people who go and get a license using this new law are then going to go out and procure insurance. There is nothing in this bill that sets up a system whereby they're going to get insurance at the same time they're getting a license. It assumes they're going to take action that's not considered in the bill. As to the general concept that this is something that is necessary, the only part of this bill that I see as necessary is bringing New York into line with the standards that are in effect in most of the world. If I hop on a plane, head over to Italy, I have a New York State driver's license, they'll rent me a car and I can drive without a problem. That's not so much the case in New York or most of the other states. So I do believe that, yes, if you come here and you have a foreign driver's license, and especially if you have paperwork pending in regards to your residency, yes, you should be issued a temporary license until everything is cleared. But just taking the doors completely off and saying everyone can come in and get a license is crazy. What standards are even going to be implemented? From what I've seen, the determination now is not proving your citizenship, it's proving identity. And they're going to accept foreign passports, foreign birth certificates, foreign documents that, you know, your average worker at the desk at the DMV is not qualified to determine the authenticity of. You're not going to have someone at the DMV who can take a look at a Peruvian passport, a Venezuelan passport, some other document and say, yep, that seems legitimate. They have no idea. And unless there's going to be some type of training or they're going to have on-site document experts. You're just blowing off the doors for people to bring in documents they created on the computer. There's no one to be able to issue an authoritative stance that documents are accurate.
Okay, so I guess the question comes down to implementation of the law and how it affects whether undocumented residents or visitors or to whom it actually affects, to whom it applies. So we're going to move on now. New York State is also considering legalizing recreational marijuana. I read today that this measure is unlikely to pass. That was actually said by the sponsor of the bill. What do you think of that move?
I think that it was established a little earlier in the year when Cuomo stopped being quite so gung-ho about passing the bill. It was originally included as part of the budget in an effort to force it to pass. And there was so much backlash from both sides of the aisle that now we're in a place where there's just about no chance of it getting passed before the session ends. Cuomo mentioned a few months ago that he didn't expect it to pass any longer, and I don't either, but I do believe this isn't a bill that's just going to go away. It's going to pop up next session, and hopefully then it'll be the time that it will pass. It is overdue. I do believe that legalizing the recreational use is not necessarily a bad thing as long as it's implemented correctly and there is a robust implementation system that is built into that bill. It includes the creation of an entirely new agency to supervise the production, the testing, and the distribution. There's a multi-tiered license system for growers, distributors, sellers, and it splits them up so that someone who owns a grower's license will not be able to maintain a retailer's license at the same time. This seems like a small thing, but it's not. It is designed to increase the amount of people who can get involved into the industry so that already existing players can't just simply move in and take over the entire vertical.
Let me ask you a question. If marijuana becomes legal, recreational marijuana, and if drivers are smoking or taking marijuana in any way and then drive under the influence of the marijuana, do you think that makes our roads less safe? Do you think that there will be any new legislation on that in that condition?
There's been some pretty groundbreaking progress in recent years there's at least two companies that have been designing breathalyzers that not only measure alcohol but also marijuana in your system. The issue that remains outstanding is how to interpret that data, because we have established, at least for now, that when it comes to alcohol, 0.08 is the line in the sand. There's not been enough research done yet to determine what amount of marijuana in your system is that equivalent to the 0.08 for alcohol. I don't think that you're going to see more people on the road having used marijuana than you already see. It's not like this isn't something that's fairly pervasive in society already. And Nassau specifically, their resistance to this bill, and they're saying that they are going to opt out of allowing it, is almost inviting more people to drive while under the influence, because if they're going out to Suffolk or Queens to partake, then how are they getting back?
Right. So, and you're talking about Laura Curran, the Nassau County executive, who has stated she will opt out if New York State votes to legalize.
She has stated that, but it was also followed by the Nassau County legislature. And it's pretty interesting to me that the basis for putting forward the bill in the legislature that they're going to opt out was based on a study done by the person who was advancing the bill and the Nassau County police chief. That does not seem like the two most objective people to perform a study on the effects of legalizing recreational marijuana.
You're saying there's a conflict of interest between the study and the purported legislation?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we'll have to follow that and see what happens, whether during this year or maybe next year if it comes back before the legislature. And speaking of driving, Dan, I read in Newsday on June 12th that the New York State Legislature is voting on a bill to join only 19 other states which require safety belt use in the rear seat of automobiles. New York State already requires that children under the age of 16 use safety belts in the rear seat. I don't know which fact surprises me more, that only 19 states have this law or that New York State does not require everyone to wear a safety belt. Co-sponsor Assemblyman Walter Mosley, Democrat of Brooklyn, asserted that a rear seat passenger's likelihood of surviving a car accident is three times greater if he or she is wearing a seatbelt. I don't know, Dan, anything else you want to share with our listeners?
Sure, just as it relates to that seatbelt law, that's the way that the legislative process is supposed to work. You take a look at objective research that was done, realize that there is an implementation to be made that's easy, that's simple, and that affects people and is beneficial. And that's how it should work, not the other way around, where you already reach a conclusion and then you go out and seek out evidence to support your already reached conclusion. I would just like to say, wrapping up, in more big picture, when it comes to the court system, on the civil end, the system is fairly well designed to give plaintiffs and defendants a fair shake. When it comes to criminal law, that's not the truth. The deck is stacked against you. As it stands now, prosecutors are not even required by law to turn over documents and discovery until the eve of trial. Can you imagine being charged with a heinous crime and not even knowing what evidence is being held against you until you've already had to most likely forego any plea opportunity? And now you're on the eve of trial. There is some legislation that was just passed in New York, and I'm actually very excited for it, that is going to require the DA within 15 days of arraignment to turn over certain specific documents. But even that amount is such a boon to a defendant who's facing criminal charges, because they can actually know what's being said and what the strength is of the case against them.
What I hear you saying is really the deck is stacked against the defendant and in favor of the prosecutor and the police.
Absolutely, without a doubt. This is why when you are facing criminal charges, it is so important to find a criminal defense attorney who's not only competent, but that you trust. When you're arrested, when you're faced with criminal charges, you're not just worried about jail. You're worried about losing your professional licenses. You're worried about your reputation. There is so much at stake that an investment in a good criminal defense attorney may just be the best purchase that you make.
Okay. And with that, that's it for our fourth episode. Thank you, Dan, for coming on the podcast. That was so informative and interesting.
Thank you.
And if anyone has any further questions or wants to talk to Dan about a pending case, please check our show notes for his contact information. And to our listeners, be sure to download this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please rate us, hopefully 5 stars, with a review that could start on this beautiful summer day while I'm driving on the Southern State Parkway with my seatbelt on, of course, on my way to pick all kinds of berries, which are ripe at Lewin Farms. I will definitely pass the time driving by listening to the Long Island Law Podcast, the LI Law Podcast, so that I know what's going on Long Island and I can hear helpful and positive tips which educate and entertain. Thank you for listening.